Hello, this is Lily, and you're now listening to The Real World on CITR 101.9 FM. The Real World, if you haven't tuned into this show before, is UBC Film Society's radio segment where we talk about all things film related. We are on every other Thursday from 4 to 5, so don't miss us. I'm Lily, like I said, as usual, and I'm joined by
Emma.
Oh, wait, let me get your...
Oh, yeah, there we go. This is Emma.
I muted you by accident, Emma. I don't know why I muted her because, unfortunately, I was missing her last episode, and I'm beyond happy, however it might seem, since I muted her mic just now. I'm very glad that she's back for this episode. So we're going to be getting into a few of Emma's picks later this episode after we do some ads. And just before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from the unceded territories of Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. So like I said, we're going to get into some ads before we circle back.
MRG Live is pleased to present the legendary DJ Shadow live at the Vogue Theater on January 23rd. Don't miss your chance to catch this pioneering producer performing music from his latest release, Action Adventure, alongside his rich 3-decade-long catalog, which includes collaborations with artists such as Run the Jewels, Nas, and De La Soul, among others. For tickets, head to admitone.com and search for DJ Shadow.
In the beginning, there was Thumb.
Something strange and funky condensing out of the primordial ooze. Then, underground house parties and backyard raves. Stuff of legends still whispered about in Los Angeles. And now, the space barn blasts off, and Thumpasaurus is ready to engage a new frontier in the Thumpiverse. Don't miss Thumpasaurus live at the Biltmore Cabaret, January 18th, presented by MRG Live. Head to admitone.com to get your tickets now.
Looking to get a reliable and affordable used bike? Need a repair or service to your current ride?
Come to the Bike Kitchen, UBC's full-service community bike shop, located in room 36 of the UBC Life building. Our hours are Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
If you buy a bike from us, bring it back when you're done using it, and we'll give you half of your money back, as long as you took care of it. If it needs repairs, we'll split the cost with you.
Yep, you heard us right. We'll give you crisp dollar bills for half the original price of any used bike that you buy from us, minus the cost of repairs.
For more information about our buyback policy and to stay up to date on any COVID-19 inspired changes, find us online at thebikekitchen.com.
Whoa, hold on. Where are you taking all those cacti?
I need to put them near the radio.
How come?
They love to hear Everly's nature-based music on Dead Succulent Haunt every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CITR 101.9.
Oh, Dead Succulent Haunt? Where your plants can grow and you can mourn those you've lost?
Come on, plants, let's grow.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
All right. This is Lily. You're still listening to The Real World. Before we get started, I'm just going to give a couple updates for the UBC Film Society, because that's where me and Emma are coming from right now. Keep an eye on our events and updates. Most of them will be posted to UBC Film Society on Instagram. You might see that our weekly double feature, we were supposed to screen Vertigo at 6 o'clock and Asako 1 and 2 at 8:30, which is in the Egg in the Nest. Unfortunately, we had to postpone this just due to weather conditions. But like I said, we do double features every week. Try to come out because they're well curated and it's always nice when we have a big show. Anyway, let's get into our episode. Today is kind of like a part two of what we did a couple weeks ago. Last live episode, we did a spinoff on like Spotify Wrapped, that type of thing where we recap what we listened to this past year. So some, what I did were I highlighted a few of my favorite scores and soundtracks that came out in 2023 films, which was a lot of fun. We talked about like Barbie the album. We talked about The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, Past Lives, all sorts. If you didn't get a chance, you should listen back because I don't know if this is going to end up being the same for you, Emma. I'll hear in a second, but I kind of found myself like just gravitating towards films that I just really liked and then looking at their soundtracks and scores. I'm not sure like what comes first. Is it like what were my favorite sounds and scores, or do you just kind of go to the movie you like and then you kind of just like the soundtrack or score because it's associated with that movie?
Yeah, I feel like that happens like a lot.
Yeah.
Usually if I'm not drawn to a movie like by the soundtrack, then I just end up liking the movie. Like, yeah, the soundtrack goes crazy. I love it.
Yeah.
But it's not usually like there's a lot of overlap between like my favorite scores and my favorite movies. The Venn diagram's like a circle.
Yes, I agree. They go hand in hand. It is a circle. So those were some of the films I talked about last week, or not last week, it would be last live episode. And they were all 2023 films, but today, because Emma's back, we're going to expand. We're doing part two, but extended version. We're not just talking about 2023. We're just going to soundtracks and scores that we love. So, Emma, do you want to introduce the first film you want to talk a little bit about?
Yeah, totally. So the first film that we're going to be talking about today is Baby Driver, which was released in 2017 and directed by Edgar Wright. And honestly, this is one of my favorite movies of all time and one of my favorite scores of all time. The soundtrack is, I think it's one of the first movie soundtracks I ever bought on vinyl.
Oh, yeah?
It's like, oh, yeah. My pride and joy. And I used to listen to the soundtrack like when I was practicing for my driver's exam. Just get in the headspace. Like, yeah.
Something's got to get you in the headspace because I don't know about you. Those are the most stressful times of my life. Like when I was taking driving tests.
Oh, terrible. anxiety levels were through the roof.
Yeah.
The worst.
And I mean, it helped baby focus. So.
Exactly. I was like, yeah, just buy Osmosis. I'm going to be as good as him on the roads.
That's actually so funny. You've got a record player?
Oh, yeah. I lugged it all the way to Vancouver with me.
But oh, my gosh. I can't believe you fit that.
Oh, yeah. It's, I love it very much. Was physical media for the win.
Yeah. Was it hard to find the vinyl or?
Not too hard. I think it was a birthday gift. So I don't know if I wouldn't have found it myself. But I do know it wasn't like impossible to track down. But it isn't like super readily accessible either. But I do recommend checking it out if you ever get chance to get it a physical medium.
Okay, and before we get any more into Baby Driver, we need to like preface that. When did you see this? Did you see it when it came out?
I did not. I saw this maybe I think 2019 for the first time, so a few years after it was released.
Okay. I saw it 2 days ago. So I watched it since I knew we were going to talk about it on this episode. And I'd always wanted to see it, but it just was something that I missed. So I'm not going to act like this has been a long time favorite of mine. But you watched it quite a few years ago. So
This was like, I think when I saw it for the first time, it was kind of when I was like phasing out of Marvel movies and like Star Wars, like just kind of getting stuff where I was actually like thinking about movies in a way.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't just going, like, my parents would pop something in a DVD player and be like, yeah, all right, this is the best movie ever made. Like, this is when I was kind of getting into movies for the first time. And Baby Driver was just, like, such a breath of fresh air. Like, I remember watching it and being like, this is what movie making is about. It's, like, translating your passion onto the screen, just kind of throwing it out there in the hopes that someone will see it and just recognize how much of yourself you put into the film. So it reminded me of like kind of how personal films are. And I just remember like, yeah, finishing the movie and being like, I need to rewatch this immediately. And
yeah.
Just dragging as many friends as I could to be like, okay, we're going to watch Baby Driver today.
It's something to watch with friends. I wish I hadn't watched it alone since I was kind of in a rushed mood trying to get it done. But it's definitely something I wish I could have seen in theaters. Like, it's got that energy. Yeah. The soundtrack is part of something that makes it like a fun movie theater or like friend watching experience. Yeah. You want to be with other people when you watch this.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Oh, absolutely. I think like, yeah, the reason it's so rewatchable is almost like because of how rhythmic it is. Like, it kind of feels like you're watching this long music video, just how they work the music into the movie that you don't always see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, honestly, one of my pet peeves with movies is when you hear like they'll play the song, only play like 30 seconds of it, and then just fade it into the background.
Yeah,
so disappointing. Yeah. I don't know, but yeah, here it's like the whole song is being played, and it's just it's creates this like energy that really keeps the whole film just pushing forward the whole time.
Something I was thinking about when I was watching it is just the way it was a breath of fresh air for you, like you said, and it was also a breath of fresh air for me because it's adding to this collection of films. If you haven't seen Baby Driver, it's about like a getaway driver.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's silent and he loves music.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're thinking of any other movie right now, but you might be because it's adding to a collection of films that are about silent but brilliant, musically focused getaway drivers.
Yeah.
And we could do a whole episode on this because I was looking into like, there's a long history of that exact type of character. And so we see Baby, which is Ansel Elgort.
Yeah.
Is that how you pronounce his name? As Baby in Edgar Wright's Baby Driver. But there's also Drive back in 2011. Have you seen?
I have.
So I didn't love Drive.
Me neither.
And that's what I mean. If I was watching this and I'm like, okay, I'm seeing a pattern. I was kind of like already like, oh, here we go again.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but not even because it's just a completely different tone. Like the mood is completely different. I wasn't like, it's copy and pasted. Like I was like excited. It wasn't about to be disappointing, but it was a breath of fresh air for me at least because it just took a new, much more entertaining spin on the silent getaway driver for me.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because I think I watched Drive after I watched Baby Driver. So I went in being like, okay, I've got Baby Driver as like my frame of reference.
Yeah.
Then watched all the way through Drive and was like, this is not at all what Baby Driver was for me. Like, you know, if you boil it down to its bare essentials, it's kind of like, oh, getaway driver. They are similar in many regards, but I don't know. Baby Driver just does it better.
They're completely different. Yeah. And I do, it was disappointing because I do like Ryan Gosling and I do love Carey Mulligan, but it's a different vibe. And that's not as far back as it goes. Like, I was looking it up and there's also The Driver, 1978.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that one. I don't know if you have, but this is like a thriller film from Walter Hill. I don't know. Maybe we need to watch this. Maybe I don't know where it's going to lead us. But it needs to add to our collection of these same kind of characters we've seen.
Oh, yeah, getaway driver rabbit hole.
Yeah, that's what I'm about to go down. But that's how it was a breath of fresh air for me. I was excited about it. But like you were saying, like, let's talk more about the music. Enough about the getaway drivers. Music in this film of this getaway driver plays like a key role in driving the plot.
Yeah.
It's like essential to everything moving forward, how the main character feels, what the scene that's about to happen, not only drawing his focus in, but ours as well.
Mm-hmm.
And especially like the intro song that we're going to play later.
Yeah.
But that's like the first thing that we see really like snap him into focus.
Yeah.
And what I found is like when they throw that at you, like the intro to a song and it's kind of loud and it's whipping, like it's a lot of very, very energetic songs.
Oh,
it's not just him who starts to focus, but like, you know, okay, something's about to happen. Something's about to change. We've got to focus.
Yeah.
Because like there's a lot going on in these scenes when it's about heists and robberies before he's the driver for the criminals.
Yeah.
But you've got to focus on everything that's going on. Otherwise, like you're going to miss something.
Oh,
that's
totally
what it feels like, kind of.
Yeah. And even like Edgar Wright said, like about like picking the songs for this movie, he focused on like songs that had like interesting things happening, like tempo changes or differences in volume. I think that does really add to it, like these energetic sort of songs playing throughout most of it. And the ones that aren't energetic really stand out. Like I think it's Easy that they use at one part.
Yeah.
Like I think Is there a cover of that as well?
Wait, is it like the one that's like easy like a summer? Yeah. Yeah, they play that a couple times, which mm-hmm. I noted, and that's like the one that also his mom
yeah.
sings like in her cover.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of something that comes up a couple times. It's once when I said he was leaving like this the lot where like all the yeah. cars get destroyed and he's walking away from this destruction mm-hmm. that he's part of this world, because mostly the main character is, you kind of love him, like he's warm-hearted.
Yeah.
Not the same as Ryan Gosling in Drive, but like he's got something about him that's some sort of innocence, like he's not meant for this world. Mm-hmm. And he tells the love interest,
yeah.
Lily James's character, like, you don't belong in this world. But like yeah. the whole time you're kind of like, you don't either. Yeah. You just need someone to tell you that too. And so he's going to like this destruction where they destroy the cars and you're just like, you're not meant to be here. Like, you're meant to be having an easy Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And that's when they play that.
Oh, totally. And yeah, I think, yeah, it really stands out because of how, like, low-key it is compared to the rest of the songs.
Yeah, that's so
it's
true.
Just like, it's go, 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 go until it's stopped. And you're like, whoa, okay, this guy is, he's just some guy. Like, he does not have a place in all of this.
Mm-mm. And he's just had a tough life. Like, yeah. Multiple things that have brought him to where he is.
He's just a victim of circumstance.
Exactly. And then there's also, it's just funny, like, I like that when he first meets Lily James' character, what's Deborah. Yeah, and they've also got all these songs that go with their names, mm-hmm. which was cool, all the songs about Baby, because there's, like she said, there's a million songs about your name, yeah. because he goes by Baby. But then they've also got the song about Deborah.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's a movie made for music lovers, I would say.
No, totally.
Do you want to talk about the song that you chose or highlight any of the other songs before we get into that one?
Yeah, so I chose Bell Bottoms by the John Spencer Blues Explosion. And so Edgar Wright was actually inspired to make this movie by the album Orange from the John Spencer Blues Explosion.
Okay.
And it's, yeah, basically John Spencer's voice is like the first thing that you hear in this movie, just kind of playing off this idea of like, this is what generated this whole thing for Edgar Wright. So I think this is kind of like the movie, you know, you're kind of going in, you're not really knowing what to expect, and it just hits you like right off the bat, cold open, pretty much. Just, yeah, he's in the car, the song starts playing, and it just goes from there and doesn't slow down until the end. So yeah, I think this movie just really captures like the feeling of, or this song really captures the feeling of the movie.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It really snapped me into it right away. Yeah, like you said, this is, the band is like this rock band
mm-hmm.
from, they formed in the 90s, and it, you've got that feeling, and it's all about just like wanting to dance, and like, I don't know if it's about maybe what I'm thinking about, at least for Baby's character, of like wanting to dance, but just yeah. like you said, like not being in the circumstance where mm-hmm. just having fun and escaping this kind of life that's drawn him in, this criminal life, because he needs yeah. money, like that's the reason he's doing it kind of thing, wanting to escape that, like it's about this urge to just dance and love yeah. and enjoy life.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's completely infectious, the song, and it's got this like repetitive feel that just, it's so easy to get to know the lyrics of it because yeah. it repeats, and then he starts singing it and it makes you want to sing as well.
Oh yeah. So good. I, yeah, this song, every single time it starts the movie, I'm like, yeah, okay.
I was thinking we need to make, like, a video to that song to promote this episode.
Oh, yeah.
Because I just, like, what else is going to draw the audience in? Like, exactly. The way you feel when you start watching Baby Driver.
Yeah, no, it works for Baby Driver, you know? It's going to work for the real world as well.
That's what I'm saying. Okay, well, do we want to get started on playing that? You got any other notes?
Yep,
what people should be doing when they listen to the song? Maybe dancing?
Absolutely dancing.
Absolutely.
Or if you're going to commit a heist, do it now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do it now. Get ready, because we're about to play the song. This is your moment.
We'll be right back. explosion.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Right now, I got to tell you about the fabulous, most groovy Bell Bottoms. Bell Bottoms.
We're back. That was Bell Bottoms by the John Spencer Blues Explosion, and we played it because it was featured in Baby Driver's soundtrack. We just talked about Baby Driver because you're listening to The Real World, the UBC Film Society's radio show. So we're doing all about movie soundtracks and scores today, just highlighting a couple favorite ones because, like, there's just so many. So we picked four films to talk about today, and we just covered Baby Driver, which, if you're like me and you're late to the Baby Driver game, because now I'm a huge fan, obviously, I'm going to, like, recommend it to all my friends as if I've always been an advocate. But you should watch it. And especially if you're the type of person who, I was thinking about it, if you can't like get on the bus or like get in the car and start going before like you have a song going, just because you're not the type of person who can commute or like do your work in silence, this is a film that I was thinking would definitely resonate with you, because everything about the timing of the film is based on music. Like the main character can't drive, he can't like complete these really like high intensity tasks because he's on a timeline, because he's a getaway driver for extreme criminals. But at the end of the day, like, it's music that will like help him carry on. Like, that's what he needs to time.
It's music that drives him.
It's movie. It's music that drives the driver.
There we go.
There's something there. I don't know what's there, but there's something. Or another part I was thinking about is like the way that this huge dramatic moment with a huge explosion, without giving anything away, because like whatever, that's very vague. is timed with tequila and the huge explosion. So everything is coinciding with like the drop of a beat or tequila or other things that are happening in the music. That's what's driving everything. So if that sounds like something that's going on in your life, you might resonate with this film.
Absolutely, check it out.
Anyway, let's move on to, do you want to introduce, Emma, the next
film? So our next film, total tonal shift, but we're going to be talking about The Witch, which was released in 2015, directed by Robert Eggers. We're talking about the score for this because there's not really much of a soundtrack.
Okay.
There's no real music in it, and that was with intent, apparently, for him. So the composer, Mark Corvin, has been composing since the 80s, actually. One of his first jobs was the Twilight Zone reboot. But, which is crazy. Yeah, he's just been in the horror genre, I guess, for that long. But I guess for this score, he kind of wanted to work with, he uses like orchestral noises to mimic the sounds of farm animals instead of using actual farm animals to create the sense of like you recognize something but it's off, like there's something that's just not quite
like it feels right. Like you're hearing an animal, but it's just something a bit distorted or weird about it,
something that's like not quite like a cow or something like that. And so it's like unsettling, like as you're listening, like you know like what you're hearing, you recognize it, but it's not something's off, which is just like kind of the theme of this whole movie. He's kind of playing Robert Eggers, the director. He won, he won Best Director at Sundance for film, which is, I think, is deserved. This is my favorite Robert Eggers film. So
the only other one I've seen is The Northman.
Yeah, that's honestly my least favorite.
Okay.
It's so long. I don't know.
You've seen The Lighthouse?
Yeah.
Okay, that's also on my list, as well as The Witch. I haven't seen The Witch, but I don't know. Is it the same? Like, how did you describe this genre? Like, The Witch is based on the Salem Witch Trials? Like, is that what it's, the root of the premise is based on the very popular premise that people have used in a lot of films of the witch trials? Like, is this a common, since I've only seen The Northman, is this common in his filmography?
I think he does, play around a lot with the idea of, like, folk sort of horror, like folk something horror. Where it's like there's something there beneath the surface where you know something's happening but you don't quite know what. It's not like overt like jump scares and like a figure that you see, like it's just like, oh, there's something in the woods or there's something in the water, like you're very much, you're aware, it's like there's a presence but you don't know what the presence is,
right? And like, you said this is your favorite genre of horror.
Yes, I love folk horror so much. I am number one folk horror fan. Anyone who knows me knows that I adore it so much. I think it's just such an interesting way of like how we can build up the sense of horror that usually tends to be more psychological, and I think that's really interesting because, like, don't get me wrong, I do love a good slasher. Scream, number one in my heart.
Yeah,
but there's something about folk horror, specifically how like Robert Eggers does it, that is just so compelling.
Right.
Like, I guess he says that this movie, it was kind of about the dread, fear, and human capacity for judgment, which is just crazy for a horror movie
to be
dealing
with. That's a lot.
Yeah. And I was heavily inspired by like his youth and sort of growing up in New England, And he says that the woods behind his childhood home were haunted by New England's past. So clearly this guy has just been he's just been going through it since he was a kid, I guess. Because that's a crazy line to drop. But
Someone help him.
Oh, yeah. Can we check up on Robert Eggers, please?
Please.
Like, what's up with him?
We need to start talking about this. Okay, I don't know what I'm more scared of. That's a really interesting way to describe folk horror. So It's different from like jump scares. It's more of just like an uneasy, unsettling, underlying just like feeling.
Yeah, like at least for me, that's kind of what I boil it down to. Like there's more, there's tons of variation in the genre, I guess. Like Midsommar is also like folk horror, and that's obviously a bit of a shift. But I think it's like really cool to see it kind of coming about more as a genre that's kind of establishing itself. I'm really curious to see where it goes in the future.
So what's like the, just no giving away, for someone who hasn't seen it, what does the witch, like who's the main character type thing?
Yeah, totally. So there's this family of like, I don't know exactly when this takes place. I want to say early 19th century. Probably that sounds wrong to me, but it's somewhere around there. This family of Puritans who have gone out to these woods and are now trying to make a go of it. And there's something in the woods, or so they think. And yeah, as the title suggests, the witch. So they think there is this witch in the woods, basically. And it's just detailing like their lives as they go about everything with this witch, this sort of fear of this witch hanging over them.
Okay. Spooky.
Very good Halloween watch. This was my Halloween watch this year. And I think it fit the mood really well. I recommend.
Okay, I'll wait till Halloween to even think about watching this, because if you know me, you know I don't watch horror anything. I can't really handle it. We had to watch, like, for our horror unit in Cinema 100, watched a Halloween, like, just Halloween. Oh, yeah. Basic kind of campy horror. Like, you can't even really describe it as true horror when people are out here making stuff like this. But that kind of thing. And I was like, oh, I couldn't handle the jump scares. But one thing I didn't know about this film was also that, did you know it's only filmed, it was shot in 25 days?
That's crazy. I didn't know that, actually.
25 days.
Oh, my God. That is wild.
I mean, anything just filmed in 25 days shocks me. I think I need to watch the movie to, like, feel the full effect because...
Oh, yeah. No, that's crazy. Like, you definitely do not feel, like, a sense of urgency at all in this. So that's crazy, that he was able to shoot that much in 25 days. But I respect it. Robert Eggers.
Yeah, geez.
Good
and
job.
And this was his directorial debut.
I think so,
yeah,
which is like, that's this is also a crazy
even more impressive debut. And then we also see that, like, he collaborates again with Anya Taylor-Joy in The Northman, so like that's kind of a duo that we've seen a couple times. I don't think she's in The Lighthouse, but that's kind of interesting, as well as this was kind of her big debut as well,
and she did so well. Like, absolute scene stealer. Oh, she's her acting is insane in this.
She's great.
Oh, yeah.
So what about the score do you like so much? Is it just kind of go with the haunting feeling of it?
Yeah, like just how much went into it. Like this idea of, the something that is almost but not quite something you recognize.
Right, yeah.
I think that's a really interesting idea that Mark Corvin is kind of playing with. And just how, like, it was mostly shot like naturalistic lighting or whatever. And how kind of naturalistic the score feels right up until the end, when it sort of starts to ramp up a bit without saying anything. But... yeah, no, it's definitely, like, it's just such a haunting sort of score where it's so low-key and it's, like, it feels like you almost miss it, but it is, like, something about it. It's just so, just get, like, bone-chilling.
Okay, which is different than what you see in, like, the campy horror genre of just, like, kind of, it's a little more out there and at you of, you can feel it ramping up and then something huge, like, big slam of the door type thing.
Yeah.
A little bit more low-key. So you picked the song Follow the Goat.
Yes, which is from near the end of the film. I want to say one of, like, second or third last score.
Okay.
But yeah, I think this one is really, just sort of captures the feeling.
Okay, well, I haven't listened to it at all, so if you haven't heard this either, we'll do a little live reaction afterwards. But are we ready to get into that now?
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a listen.
Thank you.
God, Emma.
Yes.
That was so scary. I do not want to watch this movie now.
I'm not doing a good job of selling it. I'm now realizing.
No, you are. You are. Like, it gets you. You described it perfectly. It's, like, definitely chilling. Like, that felt like, I was thinking, like, bones, like, clattering to the ground. Like, a bunch of tiny bones, like, falling. Like, that's the image I had with that last, like, drop.
Yeah. No, it's so visceral. Such an insane score. But, oh, yeah.
Okay, well, I don't know. I'll watch it. I swear. I'm committed now since I know so much background information that you've told me now. I kind of need to. Let's move on to our next film we're going to talk about. You chose it. All of these films are chosen kind of for whatever drew you to, like, their soundtrack and score. But also we were talking about how that a lot of the time goes hand in hand with just, like, a favorite film.
Yeah.
Right?
No, absolutely. Yeah, because the next movie we're going to be talking about is Donnie Darko. And honestly, this is another, like, Halloween favorite for me.
Okay.
Personally, I watched it fairly recently, I think in the past year or so. But yeah, even from the first time I watched it, like, yeah, this is something that's so unlike any other movie.
Yeah, I think I thought I had seen it, but then I started watching and I got to this, I was doing a rewatch and I got to this point where, yeah, I definitely have never seen this part before. So I think I just had never finished it because I started a while ago and now I've done most of my rewatch pretty recently. Like, I started it recently. So it's not, like, a longtime favorite of mine, but also from the rewatch I've gathered, it also has a spooky vibe, which now we know Emma's thing, not my thing. I think that's what's going to help this show kind of have a wider, I don't know, we're drawing on a couple more genres than it would be if only you or only I was hosting. So when did this become a favorite of yours?
I must have seen it this summer,
okay,
which was, yeah, fairly, very recent, actually. But I remember watching it, and then I didn't really understand it. You know, I had to do, like, the what is Donnie Darko about? Donnie Darko ending explained sort of thing. But now, read a few articles, and I can be pretentious about it now. And I think how the soundtrack, like, this sort of 80s songs, but not in, like, the way of, like, Stranger Things, sort of, like, just to pull nostalgia, but, like, 80s songs to invoke a very specific feeling. Like, Richard Kelly said, like, the sound, or he's the director, and he said, like, the soundtrack, he wanted it to have a very romantic sort of, like, let's get through this sort of feeling unique to high school. Like, you're really trying to romanticize everything, but at the end of the day, like, you just need to pass.
Yeah.
Get a math test tomorrow. Like,
at the end of the day, it's a relief when you hear that the school is closed.
Exactly. It's like, this is not, like, the Breakfast Club.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And just, yeah, I guess, like, the songs, they sort of start off very energetic, and then as everything, like, all these events kind of fall into place, we end with this, like, super stripped down quiet cover of Mad World, which I think, yeah, just the shift in tone on the soundtrack really, really ties in with how the movie grows and changes in a really interesting way.
Yeah, I was definitely creeped out a little bit, but the way that the music progresses throughout, because it starts a little bit, I don't know, lighter, like you were saying. But just, like, recap in case people haven't seen it. This is about Donnie Darko, like the character of the title, which is Jake Gyllenhaal, which I haven't seen a lot of his stuff. Like, I know that he's got this, like, massive following, like, best actor ever, whatever. But I also hadn't seen him this young in something, which was interesting on my rewatch. I was like, God, like, he's just a little guy. He started off early.
Oh, yeah. No, it's crazy.
And he sleepwalks.
Yeah. That's, like, kind the whole of. Thing.
But he's also, like, connected through time.
Yeah. It's very trippy. Like, trying to describe it without spoiling anything is, like, so tough. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. But there are big questions of a big theme that we'll also see come up in the song is there's a lot about, like, I don't know, like, our actions, fate and free will.
Yeah.
Things like that. And I think that comes up a lot as a theme throughout the film of, like, how we're guided by, like, some sort of, like, darker being telling us, like, where to go. It's kind of, I don't know, like, the devil and angel on each shoulder, except he's kind of just got the devil, like, telling him what to do. And that's kind of tackled in the song, I felt, like, encompassed through the lyrics. I don't know if you felt that, too.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Like, definitely, I prefer, because there was, you know, technically two releases, or like the theatrical release opened with The Killing Moon, but then the director's cut opened with Never Tear Us Apart.
Oh, yeah.
And I honestly prefer The Killing Moon, but I might just be biased because I do prefer the song itself. But I think The Killing Moon, like just the lyrics really work with the theme of the movie to create this sense of destiny and fate and just toying with all these ideas around that.
Yeah. So it plays like first scene, basically, mm-hmm. right? When he's like biking back home,
yeah.
We see him and we get introduced to how he is kind of controlled by something, or like he sleepwalks. He's doing something that he's not completely having full free will and like decision making yeah. power at night, kind of thing. And
yeah.
then he ends up in these random places. And then he's biking back home and this song comes on, mm-hmm. and it's got kind of like a rock feeling. It was from like the English rock band. I don't know. Do you know anything else about Echo and the Bunnymen?
I know they're playing actually a show in Vancouver soon.
Really?
Yeah, it's 19 plus, so I can't go, but God, how I want to.
Yeah, seriously. Wait, I should go.
Yeah, pull up.
That'd be crazy. I can't believe that. So the song is old. Like, I don't know. Are they touring a new?
I have no idea. I know they're coming, but I don't know like any more details.
Okay, we got to find out some details about this, because this song was released like in 1984. Like, it was
yeah.
a really old song, but it's got kind of the vintage feel. And I don't know like when the film is set. Like, he's in high school in...
Yeah, I don't, it's, yeah, it's sort of nebulous, because, yeah, it was released in 2001, but
yeah.
I can't recall exactly when the film is supposed to be set.
Yeah, well, it's got this really, like, lonely feeling to mm-hmm. it, which is also tackled a lot, another theme that comes up in the movie a lot, of, like, whether he's lonely, what it is to be lonely, like, if we follow God, like, can we really be lonely if we follow yeah. the path we're supposed to follow? Also, like, the tie into, like, religious symbols as
oh,
well.
Yeah.
But, like, the tone of the song... And the film is kind of like slower, deals with loneliness, maybe isolation kind of
totally.
A little bit. And it relates to like the energy that's guiding him
mm-hmm.
throughout the movie. When I can't recall the exact lyric of the song, but it's kind of talking about the forces behind our actions.
Yeah. It's like fate up against your will.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
That. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's definitely a very thematically appropriate song.
Absolutely. And I was thinking also about, they talk about, like, the blue moon. Like, they mentioned mm-hmm. that they're under a blue moon. So I was trying to search up, like, what the meanings of the blue moon are. And
yeah.
I guess we hear the saying of, like, once in a blue moon, like, mm-hmm. something that happens so rarely, which I think, now that I think of it, could tie into his character, because without giving anything away, like, he's kind of... He's not, like, the chosen one,
mm-hmm.
but, like, this feeling of what are the odds
yeah.
that, like, he's experiencing what he's experiencing of, like, being guided to do certain things, act in a certain way. But a blue moon also represents, like, luck.
Yeah.
Apparently, according to the internet. I don't know where I sourced this from, but, like, I guess there's so many explanations of what, like, moons could mean.
Yeah.
But I was trying to decipher, like, I don't know if Donnie Darko has any good luck.
yeah.
I would not describe his life as lucky.
Oh, yeah, no, there's definitely something there in the moon, but I don't, yeah.
I don't know. It's all happening at night. A lot of the stuff
mm-hmm.
happens at night, so I was thinking about that as well, like the power of under the moon. I'm not sure, though. This is something to think about. Like, I just thought that, like, the song is chosen so specifically, and they
yeah.
talk about... the blue moon. Maybe it's just the moon in general. I don't want to read too much into it, but yeah.
Oh yeah.
Also, that I was surprised, just like, this is a random note, it has nothing to do with the soundtrack, I just want to talk about it, of like, it's so star, like, there's so many stars
yeah.
in this film.
It's kind of crazy.
Every face I see, I'm like, you're kidding me.
Yeah.
You've got to be kidding me.
I know.
His love interest is Jenna Malone, which, if you watch The Hunger Games, is the biggest shock of your life. I haven't seen her act in something when she was so young either.
Yeah.
So that was crazy. And then, like, there's Seth Rogen.
Yeah, which is just wild that he's in there.
What is he,
like,
doing there?
I know. You're just looking at me like, okay, there's Seth Rogen. Little Seth Rogen.
Just kind of walking around. And Drew Barrymore. Her character was so strange.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit confused at her as well. And we've got those classic, like, when... whatever scene is happening in class is kind of mirroring whatever's happening in the world. Like,
yeah.
I was trying to think of another scene that I think about, but basically Drew Barrymore is his English teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about, like, what the short story that they're reading. And he's kind of, like, really smart. One of those characters, Donnie Darko, who's, like, super smart but disturbed.
Yeah.
And he, like, knows all the answers to the questions that are being asked in class. And that also felt like it was foreshadowing what was happening, like destruction, seeing times change.
Yeah.
What happens when the world ends? Because that's a big question of the film, like the world ending.
Yeah. And I think, that was like the time it was released, I guess that question had kind of come up again because it's kind of, you know, it didn't do well. It got a very limited theatrical release just because of the themes of a jet crashing into a house, like the proximity to 9/11 generally weren't boding well with Americans. But it did do well over in Europe, gained a bit of a cult following. But I guess initially Richard Kelly kind of wrote this to reflect that period of like end of Cold War listlessness that he felt growing up, that America was kind of, I guess, experiencing again with this like post 9/11, like worlds turned upside down.
Absolutely. Sort of idea. I think that's the audience that it kind of just like fits that slot really well of like questioning where do we go from here? And that constant feeling of like, which is like resonating now with all sorts of issues that are going on in the world of like that we're on some sort of timeline. Like there's this deadline that we don't know what's going to happen when we reach it.
Yeah.
But once we get to this certain day and time, like something big is going to change. And that's something that's like constantly addressed, whether it's in English class, like I was saying with Drew Barrymore as his like sassy teacher for some reason is talking about themes of world ending, world change. Yeah. And then also just throughout like all the actions that he's taking, these dark turns of what happens when we get to whatever it is that ends us.
Totally. Yeah.
Anyway, what was the song?
The song is The Killing Moon by Echo and the Bunnymen.
Okay, cool. We'll get that one going, see how we feel about that. I hope it's not as scary as the last one we had going on. But here is The Killing Moon. Okay, we're back, and that was a song from Donnie Darko, which is the film we just talked about, and we also have already talked about Baby Driver and The Witch, because we're covering some of our favorite film, movie, soundtracks, and scores. Why, you might ask? Because this is the UBC Film Society's radio show, so that's all we can talk about legally binding. Anyway, we're moving on to our fourth and final film that we're going to highlight in this part two of favorite soundtracks and scores. You want to introduce Emma?
Totally. So our last film today is The Crow, which was released in 1994 and directed by Alex Proyas. So this soundtrack, where I got Baby Driver first on vinyl, this is one of the ones I got on CD.
Okay.
It's a very big physical media person.
You're so cool for that. You're so cool for that. I could never seek those out.
And it sucks when you're moving, just lugging boxes of stuff. It's like, I have Spotify, why am I doing this?
No, you're so old school. It's very mysterious of you.
Yeah, like niche and esoteric.
You kind of don't even have a phone or a computer. Like, you don't resonate.
Yeah, I'm just calling in from, like, flip phone. But, yeah, this is, like, the soundtrack is crazy. Like, there's so many big 80s alternative, not even just 80s, just alternative music on this. Like, you got, like, The Cure, Nine Inch Nails, Pantera, Violent Femmes, and they're all just on the soundtrack. It's like, whoa.
Casually.
Yeah.
Just loaded. Casually.
Yeah. And, like, one of the songs was a Burn by The Cure. Initially, they were going to use Hanging Garden because it's mentioned in The Crow's based off a comic book.
Oh, yeah. I did read
that. And I guess the lyrics appeared in that comic book, but Robert Smith liked the comic book of The Crow so much that he decided to write an original song instead. Burn came about.
Okay.
And it was actually recorded with pretty much like a skeleton crew, I guess, of a band. It was just him and the drummer. This is the last song they ever recorded together because the drummer left the band after that.
Oh.
So
there you
this is it. But yeah, Burn by The Cure, a crazy banger to come off the soundtrack that I do listen to just in my day-to-day life. And I think, like, it's really interesting because it kind of perfectly captures the alternative music scene at the time. The Cure just kind of released Wish a few years prior, so they're kind of back in the conversation, establishing themselves as this band that wasn't going to die with the 80s. Nine Inch Nails would release Downward Spiral the same year, which has, like, some of their biggest hits ever. And they got, like, Closer and Hurt, and they're kind of back on everyone's radar. Stone Temple Pilots, who are also on this soundtrack, it's crazy. They're still largely in their infancy. They've only got two albums released, but they are their most famous albums. And then you've got Violent Femmes, and this is like 1994 was the last time for 22 years that they would release an album, which is just like,
wow,
crazy. So yeah, you've got all these bands that are kind of like growing and like dying. And it's like just all these bands in these various stages all came together to create this soundtrack. Just like, it feels like a leather coat, the soundtrack, like listening to it. I need to go buy a leather coat.
Okay. That's a really interesting way to describe it. I love that. When you watch this, were you being like, oh my God, is that this song? Yeah, it is. Yeah. Like, you already were recognizing all of them, or did you kind of like use it as a stepping point to learn more about some of the bands?
There was some, like, The Cure song I recognized, but there were others where I hadn't heard them until I listened or until I watched the movie.
Right.
Then I kind of was able to get more into these bands. Like, it was really just a big way of expanding my music taste was through this movie, just of how many different alternative bands you just kind of got a taste of, which is, you know, I think it's really cool.
I love when that happens.
Yeah.
Do a lot of the songs like go together? Like, if you were to make your own playlist of like a certain vibe, like, would you put them together or do they contrast?
They're all very cohesive, which is like interesting because they're all dynamic, but it sort of feeds off the energy of rock and roll, I guess. So yeah, dynamic but cohesive is like the best way I can describe this soundtrack.
Okay.
So the lyrics are all very thematically appropriate and like watching and listening. Like, yeah, these tracks that they would be in a movie together.
Interesting.
And one of the songs, actually, It Can't Rain All the Time, is performed by Jane Syberry, who's Canadian, but There we go. Canadian representation.
Yeah, we love Canadian representation. We were just talking about it. That's great.
And it was supposed to be written by Eric Draven, who's the main character. So I want to say that's one of the songs that closes out the movie, which is also really interesting because they make allusions to it throughout the film as this like big hit or whatever. But then, yeah, you actually hear it. And it's kind of, it's interesting to see that they were able to like make that from the movie into the soundtrack. Mm. It's kind of, yeah, I think it's really cool. And so the director, Alex Price, before working on The Crow, he largely did rock music videos.
Okay.
Which I think, you definitely see the influence in while you're watching it. Like, they're just constantly in all these empty warehouses. And you're like, yeah, there cannot be this many empty warehouses within, like, a five-mile radius in the city. But they're there regardless. And I think it's just really, it's such, like, a good electric movie. The soundtrack just heightens it so much. And one of the bands, Love Not Lisa, they didn't want their song Slip Slide Melting to be on this soundtrack, as they thought it was just going to be a quote, crappy kung fu movie. But when they found out, how could they? But they found out what it was really about. And they're like, yeah, okay, you can put it on
there. You can have it. Yeah. Okay.
It goes crazy. Yeah, what can I say? It's a banger. But I'm glad it's on there. But yeah, I think like the soundtrack just has a really dark, sort of atmospheric, moody feel. It just fits with the film's just constant rain, general gloomy city backdrop. Mm. So yeah, the soundtrack, the vibes, the whole thing, very fun watch. I highly recommend if you haven't seen it. It's a great movie.
I've got to get on it. So you picked one specific song that we're going to play a snippet of for you right now. You wanna? How did you pick that? Like, what's it called?
And then we'll get it going. This is called Color Me Once by The Violent Femmes, which is one of my favorites off the album. Honestly, I just picked personal bias for this one. I was like,
true. I love this movie. Should.
Yeah.
Okay, let's hear that then. This is from The Crow. Color Me Once, it's called. Thank you for tuning in. That was The Real World, UBC Film Society's radio show on CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you, Emma, for picking all these films. Say bye, Emma.
Goodbye, everyone.
Thanks for listening.